Well, hello, everybody. This is Randy Wooten, CEO of Maxio, and your host of SaaS Expert Voices, where we bring the experts to you to talk about what's going on in SaaS today and what trends we're seeing unfold for tomorrow. Delighted to have John Cochran, who's actually a Maxio employee. He's our director of the Maxio Institute, join us today. Welcome, John.
Glad to be here, Randy. Thanks for having me.
The Maxio Institute, for those that don't know, is our marketing arm, which looks at our 2,200 plus customers and the billing and invoicing data that we collect. Is about $16 billion of billing and invoicing data that we collect anonymously, and then starts to look for trends and insights. And we launched it about a year ago. I think Q1 of 2023 was our first report that we published, right, John?
Yeah, that's right. It's been a gradual evolution, but really we started looking at this about a year and a half ago, and each report trying to put out new and relevant insights to the broader market.
And the intention, obviously, is to help inform what's going on in the private market. There's a bunch of analysts out there that do a great job of culling through the public SaaS data and what's happening in terms of growth rates and gross retention and net retention and what they're seeing more broadly. But the private market remains opaque. There are companies out there like Benchmark and OpenView and others that produce surveys where people respond to a qualitative survey, and they're really robust. In fact, Benchmark just came out with an updated one, which is super helpful. But there are very few companies that are able to use the real billing and invoicing data to talk about what's going on. And so that's what we wanted to contribute. And it's, I know as a CEO of a company that goes in on at least a quarterly basis to talk to my board about our performance relative to the broader market, it is invaluable to have these insights in terms of understanding what's really playing out, what the trends have been. And so that's our opportunity to share. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add to the remit of the report or the Institute, John?
No, I think that's a really good summary, Randy. I think one of the things that we're able to shed a little bit of light on are some of the dynamics, you know, playing out in the public versus the private, well, really the private instead of the public markets. Like you were saying, there are a ton of analysts that cover the public markets, but there are unique challenges that the private markets face. And you typically don't know if, you know, things are kind of trending in the right direction or companies are struggling, you know, until you kind of get that press release that comes out and takes everybody by surprise. So yeah, they're just unique challenges that private companies face. And it's really helpful to be able to get a small pulse on, hey, what's going on within my cohort that my business exists in?
And so we do split the data broadly at this point between those companies that are less than $1 million and then everybody. The other thing that we bring to the table is an insight in terms of the pricing model, if they're using consumption versus more of a subscription term-based model. So there is some nuances that we're able to layer in because of our own business model. And finally, in our recent report, we at the end of the year, we introduced a vertical analysis and what's happening on the verticals, which everyone wants to know is like, hey, if I'm in fintech, how are things playing out in fintech versus martech versus developer tech? And so that's what we're going to continue to do each and every quarter. I think the thing that has been the other real driver for us is to try to make this timely. And so as a quarter closes, to come out quickly, as quick as possible with the information. Our Q1 report's a little bit delayed. That's mostly because of our capacity on our team, but we're going to give you the insights now, which is still better than waiting for the end of the year 2024 to find out what happened in 2024. So we, with our rhythm, are trying to do a flash report at the end of Q1 and Q3, and then a deep dive report at the end of H1, a calendar year H1, and end of the year. So we'll talk a little bit about what we learned in the Q1 report today, and then we'll frame up what we're expecting for the H1 report that John and team is going to sign up to deliver at the end of our the end of the podcast. So with that, John, like broadly across Q1, are we still in the recession? Have we seen a rebound? Like what's the top level?
Yeah, I think the most exciting thing that people may pay attention to in this report is that we've finally seen what appears to be an uptick in growth. And so there are nuances to it. What's driving it? Right. Exactly. We could do a little whoop whoop there. I think if you listen to NPR, they have a buzzer whenever things are going well. We need to get one of those for the podcast here, Randy. But yeah, we've seen a slight uptick in growth. And it's really something that when you look at, you know, we tried to take a look over the last 9 quarters. That's the data that we have right now. When you take a look at the trends, it is a noticeable uptick. Now, does that mean that growth is here to stay? I think, you know, we would caution strongly, being like, we're back, baby.
Yeah.
You know, Mark, growth is here, but it is notable saying, okay, it looks like there are a cohort of companies that are figuring out how to succeed, how to grow despite economic headwinds.
Yeah. And I think that has been the, for us at least, has been an awesome trend, because all last year you and I were chatting about how it had dropped off significantly, almost precipitously. And then it was just like flatlining at 14 to 15% growth for several quarters in a row. And so everyone's talking about, could we ever get back to a world where B2B SaaS is growing at 20% plus? Don't know. And to your point, one quarter of data doesn't make a trend. But as we talk about our H1 report, if we have 2 quarters suggesting that there's this recovery, I think that will be something that everyone will be looking at closely. And so then let's deep dive a little bit, John, so that we have broadly the growth. But when you double click down, there's drivers of the growth, and then, you know, by pricing model, by size, and then there's certain verticals where we're seeing growth. So it's not consistent growth for all companies across all pricing models, across all verticals. Can you give us a little bit of context on what you're seeing when we do that double click?
Yeah. So maybe we'll start with the bad first, and then we'll talk about, you know, the people who are finding a way to grow. I think one of the things that's very clear in our data is if you're facing a negotiated renewal, say it's an annual invoice or something along, you know, an annual renewal with your customers, that cohort of companies is struggling. You see that, and you see a parallel to what's going on in the public markets there. I'll use Salesforce as an example. In their earnings release, you know, that there was a noticeable drop in their stock price because they were saying, hey, people are budget conscious. They're sensitive, and they're pushing back on, you know, their subscription spend. And we're seeing that correlation play out in the data. So that cohort has not continued to grow broadly. They are still facing some of those economic headwinds. People are pushing back on their annual renewals. And it's clear from the data that we're seeing so far. To contrast that, if you are more of a usage consumption-driven company, we've seen growth continue. You know, for the past really 3 quarters, that cohort has outperformed those companies who have more of a negotiated contract model, but that gap has widened. So they've actually continued to grow. They've outpaced the growth of the prior 3 quarters. And so usage consumption is really driving a lot of the growth right now. And there's a noticeable improvement for companies under $1 million.
Let's hold it for just a second.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack. So one of the things is when we first started this report, we actually noticed that the consumption-based pricing model companies were dropping off faster than the subscription. At the time, you had a hypothesis, well, that probably makes sense that in the middle of the recession or COVID, that people that are more of a month-to-month, which is often aligned with a usage model, would pull back and we would see those companies drop. Whereas the annual contracts is more of a step function. At time of renewal, you're going to see that play out. And so to your point, I mean, there's some companies that have more of that annual motion that are feeling the pain, kind of the
right,
that had been playing out in the consumption market a year, 18 months ago. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. So a couple things going on, because I think there is a break point and the story is different depending on if you're an early stage, like the earliest stage company versus a company that has, let's call it, hit product market fit. And what's that delineation that we make? We see a noticeable difference in the trends if you're a business under $1 million versus over $1 million. One of the insights that we've noticed in the data that we look at is if you're under $1 million and you want to, you know, you're trying to get to the next level, having a negotiated model is a really good way to do there, because it's just the quantity of customers you have to win in those generally usage-based environments. It's a big burden. Or it's a big obstacle to overcome. We still see that trend playing out, but we've seen an improvement. So subscription invoicing, that still outperforms the usage cohort if you're under $1 million. However, again, in Q1, big improvement in those startup, you know, early stage companies who are deploying primarily a consumption-based model. If you are over, go ahead,
please finish your thought. I had a qualifying question, so go ahead.
Yeah. If you're over $1 million, though, that's where we see the biggest divergence. your company's hit product market fit. You already have a cohort of customers. Consumption is just outperforming. So, you know, the invoicing, negotiated renewals. And so that's kind of the dynamic that plays out. It's early stage, scrappy company. You got to kind of do whatever it takes to break past that initial barrier. Once you're above there, the companies who have found a way are the ones who have more of that. You know, you don't have to re-engage in the renewal, the negotiation. It's as you're consuming whatever widgets you sell or onboarding users, licenses, whatever it is, your growth rate, you know, it follows the usage of the business. So you're having to avoid some of those things that the negotiated companies they're just hit right in the face with right now.
Yeah. You know,
there's no negotiation. It's just, hey, they're using your product more and you're growing.
That's right. So let's go back to the distinction you're drawing between a million and those above a million. Part of the reason why we make that distinction is because we tend to sell to companies that are very early stage, even pre-revenue as they're getting their billing model up and going, up to companies like 50 million. We have companies that are greater than 100 million, but we are not playing in the enterprise space. So part of it is our corpus of data, the set of customers we have. We're focused on that space, sweet spot between 2, 3, 4 million and 40 million. But there's another reason that we focus and make a split between the $1 million and everyone else is because 80% of the companies, I think, are below $1 million broadly across, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And it just seems like that is its own dynamic. And so maybe, can you talk a little bit, is there any other reason why we make that split between $1 million and everybody else? And is there a nuance to being below $1 million in terms of product market fit or revenue architecture fit?
Yeah. I mean, there's no one-liner that encompasses why we've chosen, you know, the 1 million cohort or less. You're right. When you just take it out of the Maxim Institute, look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are a lot of businesses that say are a sole founder who's running their own business, or they just have 5 employees and they're, you know, they've found a lifestyle business or something like that where growth is not the priority. It's running a sustainable, scalable business. It's cash flow positive that can pay everybody's salaries. It's out there. But what the data, what the Bureau will put out there is they'll say most companies that start are going to fail pretty quickly within, you know, 2 to 5 years after they launch. To have a business that launches and it withstands the test of time, it's just a challenge. And so that's just the dynamic that has played out for, you know, decades. In our data, one of the reasons why we focus on the $1 million cohort is originally we thought, you know, maybe our data and the way we were slicing the analysis was wrong. But then we went back, triple checked the numbers, and we went, no, there are real differences between companies who are above that threshold and companies who are below it. And I think that informs the broader strategy that businesses need to think about as they're evolving along this growth maturity model. You know, the tactics that you employ when you're less than $1 million are different than that when you're in the 1 to 10 million. And it's different if you're 10 and above. And it changes. There are these different inflection points that companies need to be aware of. They need to think about it. You need to plan for in your growth evolution. So the $1 million cohort, the change in the analytics and the findings was, you know, really undeniable. So much so that we essentially had to call out. We said, there are these different dynamics at play.
And what we saw, I think, just to put a fine point on it, out of 1,500 customers, so we do a bunch of filtering to make sure the data is accurate. We have north of 2,200 customers broadly across Maxio. But in this specific cut of the numbers, in Q4, the growth rate for companies less than $1 million was 5%. And in Q1, that spiked up to 26%. By contrast, the companies greater than $1 million in Q4 was at 19%, and that's dropped to 16%. And so part of that is, hey, they're small companies, they grow, you know, they get a couple $100,000 and they got massive growth. But I do also think there may have been a clearing out, like a bunch of companies that were less than $1 million went out of business, right? And post-COVID, there's been some funding, especially in the AI sector and cyber and et cetera. And so I think you're starting to see companies to get to $1 million, if you're starting from zero, is like a 2 to 3 year thing, unless you're on a white hot tear. And so you're seeing companies that got founded in 2022 that are coming into focus at $1 million post-COVID, post the pullback. I think you're seeing some VC activity happening in that early stage founding. Do you have any other thoughts in terms of like this cohort of the new kids on the block that are hitting $1 million?
The one thing that, you know, when I saw a spike in the numbers in Q1, really where my mind went was, I wonder if we're having a similar trend that we really last observed back in, you know, 2008, 2009, during the last financial crisis. And one of the things that occurred then was you had, you know, there was kind of this, everybody was growing. And then all of a sudden, everything dried up. And companies who were able to get started in that cohort, you know, I think of a couple of notable ones, Dropbox, Airbnb. You can find articles published on this of like companies who launched in 2008, 2009, 2010, found a way to survive within really an unprecedented time and make it, have done phenomenally well since then. We could be seeing that dynamic playing out again. This is a very hard time for companies who want to get funding to get funding. You really have to be best in breed. You have to have the numbers. If you're going to get a bank loan, this is an expensive time to do that.
Yeah.
Given inflation, you know, business loans, they, you know, you're paying a pretty hefty premium somewhere, you know, between probably 10 to 15%. That's a real cash consideration, right, or a real cash drain to basically finance that debt. So if you're a company that has found a way to either bootstrap or you can take on funding, this could be that dynamic playing out, you know, 15 years later.
Well, we'll certainly come back in our reports, subsequent reports, and talk more about it and see what we're seeing. And then one of the things I love that you and the team do, John, is you do reach out and look at other, you contact other analysts and you quote other sources to help triangulate on what we're seeing and to put it into broader context, which I hope our listeners and readers appreciate as well. It's not just our data, it's data within context. So to that point, let's then shift to the verticals. So we've talked about the split in terms of pricing model, consumption versus subscription. You know, the world still is going to be hybrid, but what model do you use at what stage? We have a lot of data around that. We talk about what's playing out in the million and the greater than million. And then at the end of 2023, we layered in our first vertical look. But you've been able to go back and provide data for previous quarters and the trends. What did we see in the data for what are the verticals that are winning?
Yeah, most recent, the two that are really at the top of the leaderboard in Q1 are software companies in the dev engineering space, and those who also are focused on transportations, logistics, supply chains. Previously, they were kind of middle of the pack or, you know, bottom third, but they have popped to the top most recently. Super interesting when you look back and who were the, you know, the juggernauts over the prior eight quarters, take out Q1, cyber is the undeniable, you know, they're the heavyweight champ within that cohort. But we've seen a pullback in that sector. And I think some of the dynamics when we were, like you were saying, Randy, we try to contextualize the insights that we're having to some of the broader things that we're seeing from different analysts in the market. And there was a theme saying cyber has been doing phenomenally well. People have been beefing up their cyber, but there comes a point where they can't just continue to charge more and more and more for that data, because people eventually are going to say, okay, well, you know, there are other people and other competitors that are, you know, in the space, and I have to find a way to have a reasonable cyber budget. So we saw that, we observed a pullback there, but where we observed, you know, the newcomers, the dev tech, the supply chain tech, they've now risen to the top of the leaderboard.
Well, let's split those a little apart, and we don't know exactly why, but I think you and the team have developed a hypothesis for why do we think developer and engineering tech has been growing like crazy recently?
Yeah, I think, you know, our hypothesis right now, again, trying to triangulate to what we're observing in some of the private companies out there and some of the themes that we'll see as we have conversations with different companies out there, companies have had to optimize for EBITDA. For those of you that aren't familiar with EBITDA, it's basically earnings before interest, depreciation, taxes, amortization. Essentially, what's your cash flow? You know, if we had to simplify it down, cash coming in needs to be greater than the cash going out. And so one of the most expensive costs for any business is headcount, right? You know, 70% of a business's expenses is tied to headcount. And you've just observed multiple rounds of layoffs all throughout the private industry. And so you can't just, you know, cut all of your employees and then expect to continue to grow, right? You need to find a way to grow smarter, more in a more scalable fashion. And so if you're going to do more with less employees, you need to be able to supplement those employees largely with new tooling. That's the dynamic that we think is likely playing out here. You're going to need some sort of software to supplement, you know, the leaner operation that you're running as a private business right now. So that's our leading hypothesis right now, but we're certainly going to double check that when we put out the next report here in about a month.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation. And one of the things that you guys pulled together, we were talking about the carnage of layoffs in 2022 and 2023. And there's a variety of reports out there. I've heard it's up to 1 million jobs had been eliminated in 2022 and 2023 in the tech sector. TechCrunch, I think what you quote, said it was 300,000 in 2023. Whatever, it was a lot. But what they also said is the layoffs have continued, and that through basically the first quarter of this year, there was another 60,000 laid off. And I don't hear that in the press as much. It felt like at the end of the year, everyone was like, whew, we're done with the layoffs. Everyone's going to start hiring again. But I don't think that's necessarily true. So we'll be following that as well as one of those trends in terms of the layoffs as people are tightening their belts. And obviously, the two ways that you get better business performance, brute force, is you raise prices and you lay people off. And I think everybody in the software industry has done that. You've seen that in the price increase, like with Salesforce and others, where they just said, you're gonna pay 9% more in tough. And we're like, okay. And I think that's been playing out in enterprise software writ large. And then the other thing, to your point, is how to drive efficiency. One, you sort of restructure, you take advantage of labor arbitrage. I think there's another theme which you and I have chatted about and we're going to look more closely at is the assumption with VCs and PE firms in terms of AI augmentation and what these tools are going to do to make marketers more efficient at their job. And I think one area you're seeing that play out, not first person to say this, but is developers buying AI tools to like Copilot, et cetera, that are helping them produce more code or getting 80% of it done right, the QA. And so I do think I've been talking about banging this drum that CEOs and CFOs of private companies are going to have next year going into their fiscal year 25 planning cycle a line which says, and here's our AI efficiency gains. So not just tooling that you're describing, but intelligence, the augmented intelligence that is going to help us all do our jobs better. And so that's the clarion call for all functional leaders to, if you're not experimenting with AI right now and how to make you better, you're going to fall behind, especially if you're looking for investment from the top tier VCs and PE firms.
Yeah, it's pretty wild how powerful that technology can be and how it can augment. And, you know, I've seen things like, you know, it helped me get over writer's block. Well, writer's block is a huge, you know, the block, it's not called writer's block for any reason, right? You know, the block is real.
Yeah.
But yeah, to your point, you know, call it coding block, whatever it is. If you can just get more efficient, get it done quicker, it's really powerful. So I think I was reading an article actually put out by one of our Maxionauts the other day, and they were saying, you know, is AI going to replace human? You know, everybody goes to Terminator and, you know, yeah, robots are going to take over the world. I think the thing that is pretty clear is people who know how to leverage AI are going to outperform people who don't know how to leverage it.
100% agree. I remember I was CEO of a company called Rocket Fuel, which is a first generation AI company. It was the real deal AI. And we had 25 models that we were updating every night, algos, and we had 30-ish data scientists on staff and another 30 client managers, analysts that were helping with clients, customers to do marketing optimization. And we were in that boom versus doom dichotomy, Jetsons versus Terminator. You know, we were putting all the media planners out of the job. And this was like 2015. And what we tried to frame was it wasn't about artificial intelligence, it was augmented intelligence. Fast forward, guess what? Those media planners and buyers aren't doing the same thing they were doing back in 2015. They're all taking advantage of what's called programmatic buying today. And so I think we, every industry can look towards what's happened in marketing, what's happening in sales in terms of AI, and it's improving the outbound motion and qualifications, et cetera. And if you aren't playing with it, you are going to get left behind. Well, good. Well, John, I think we've covered most of the report on the industry side. I think the lowest growth rate industries, media tech, e-commerce, HR in Q1 over the last 8 quarters, e-commerce and retail, have been the lowest average growth rate, marketing and sales and media tech. Marketing, sales, and media tech don't surprise me just because that industry is totally overcapitalized. There's like 40,000 different vendors. And I think as every CFO is looking at every function and saying you need to tighten your belt, that often marketing and the advertising teams have bought a bunch of tools. And so they're being pulled back and it's being bright line is being drawn between the must have and the nice to have. And I think that's what we're seeing play out is who are the winners and who are the losers in those categories. With e-commerce and retail, with the strong consumer trends that we've seen in the broad market, do you have a sense for why they might be not growing as fast as some of the other industries?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's something that we're certainly going to take a closer look at in the next report. I had been reading some articles the other day basically saying that, you know, before we kind of had the growth at all costs, you know, the infusions of all this additional capital into the economy, consumers really were price sensitive. Hmm. And you had to have competitive prices to win somebody's business. And a lot of that went away. That conventional thought went away in 2021, 2022. And we're just now starting to see a return to you just can't continue to charge people exorbitant profits. I mean, you're observing in the public markets, a lot of these companies are having record profits and people are starting to connect the dots and go, this is not all inflation.
Right.
These are smart companies who know how to take advantage of a situation.
Right.
And now all of a sudden that's going to have to start, you know, I think we're seeing the beginning of that playing out in the, you know, the B2C market.
I think
people are getting smart. You got to compete on price.
Been reading some articles like, are we ready for another consumer contraction? So great. Well, that I'm going to put you on the spot, John. So we're teeing up the next report, which will be at the end of Q2. Hope to have it out in 30, 45 days at the end of Q2. Is other than what we've already talked about in terms of what we're focused on in our year-end report and our flash report along the dimensions we've described, do you have any Christmas presents for our readers and listeners for the next report?
Yeah, I think the thing that we've really wanted to do, Randy, is shed some light on what are, you know, we've hinted at it and said, hey, these are the top industries. What we haven't really shed a lot of light on are what are the, you know, there's a book by Jim Collins, Good to Great. You know, there are a lot of good companies, but what do the great companies do that are different than those who are good companies? That's one thing that we want to start unpacking. Like, who are the top 10%? What are the characteristics about those companies that are different than, say, a company in the top 25%? It's a big difference if you're in the top 10 versus the top 25. That's one of the things that we want to start unpacking. So
that's great. The mean versus the median versus the mode.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you start looking at it that way. A lot of our data is based on averages, but when you start getting into the mean, median, mode, the, you know, the top quartiles, top deciles, it's interesting.
Well, that's great. And I do think you have to have enough data to make it meaningful. And so obviously what is a statistically significant amount, we'll try to do it. I do think this was, I'll never forget when we came in with our year-end report for our board, Chelsea Stoner, our general partner on the board, and we talked about the $1 million, below $1 million threshold. And she's like, gosh, Randy, that just doesn't make any sense. I was like, well, what do you mean? And Battery would say they see 5,000 deals a year, of which they only do 20. And that there are still companies in that less than $1 million that are killing it. So I do think our ability to discern, distinguish, what are the top 10%, top 20%, whatever it is we have to draw, what do they look like? What's their profile versus everybody else? CJ Gustafson, one of the guys I really love to follow, just posted about the T2, D3. And you triple your first 2 years, you double for the next 3 years from 0 to 100 million in like seven years. That used to be the glide path that the acceleration path that everyone needed to hit, that everyone was funding. And I think if we are able to get into the quartile and see the strivers versus the thrivers, distinguish that by vertical, will help those companies that really want to be the world's best say, look, I got it. And this is what it means to be in this rarefied air. So with that, John, thank you to you and your team for the hard work to get this out. We're publishing it in the next day or so. And I look forward to feedback and comments on what people find valuable and what they would like in our next iteration. So thank you, John.
Yeah. Thanks, Randy. Appreciate the time.